Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. I'm Barney Hoskins. I'm sat round a table with Mr. Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Mr. Jasper Mearson-Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
And joining us today is Mr. Gary Kemp. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Barney. It's more nerve-wracking being on this side of a podcast, isn't it? Than being in charge.
Do you want to basically become the host?
Although sometimes, you know, when someone like John Bon Jovi suddenly appears on your computer screen in front of you, it can be a bit disconcerting at first.
Yes, yes. Well, we'll be talking about your wonderful Rock on Terrace podcast that you do with Guy Pratt, Mr. Guy Pratt, later. Why am I turning into Mr. Porter, Nessa Porter? Anyway, thank you so much for coming into Hammersmith to talk about your career and your musical passions. And we'll be discussing New Romanticism and Pink Floyd and David Crosby. And as I say, your own excellent podcast, Rock on Terrace. But let's start with your earliest sort of musical epiphanies as a kid growing up in North London. Was there a pop moment that sort of changed your life?
Yeah, this has been wheeled out a lot over the years, and a lot by other artists too, and it's probably Bowie doing Starman on top of the Pops was such a key thing for me. And I did see it in black and white. I saw it in a friend's bedroom on a tiny TV that was on a cupboard, like a high wardrobe. I remember looking up at it, which is probably the right way to look at Bowie. and how I felt. I'm kneeling on the floor. And, you know, that moment when he points his finger down the barrel of the lens and says, I had to phone someone, so I picked on you.
I had to phone someone, so I picked on you.
And, of course, it was me and millions of other kids who saw it at the same time. I don't know why it was so extraordinary. I think the homoerotica element of it, when he drapes his painted fingernails around the shoulders of Mr. Ronson, had a certain frisson about it. I think the short spiky hair.
Mm. And actually a mullet. It's actually a mullet.
Yeah, a mullet. Well,
that's coming from a man who's written a book about mullets.
The mullet was actually, now remind me, who was the girlfriend? Marie Helvin was on the front of a magazine, Nova, I want to say. What is that magazine?
Yeah, there was a great magazine.
Right. Yes,
Nova.
And she wore a Japanese kabuki wig. And Bowie saw that, and he said to his hairdresser, and that could be Mick Ronson's wife,
Susie Fossey, right.
And he said, I like my hair like that. Yeah. Cut my hair like that.
Yeah.
So it was based on a Japanese kabuki wig anyway. But it's in your book, I'm sure, if you've done a book on mullets.
I did a little book on glam and book on mullets. where glam and mullets coincide.
Yeah. And, so that, you know, was I remember walking home that evening really feeling changed, because I think he was this sort of slight bisexuality of him, and of course he did the famous Enemy interview, didn't he? Gave me something dangerous to present to my parents, probably, because long hair was fairly dull by then. It had been going on for quite a while, and I remember my dad being very angry about the Rolling Stones. When my dad was a printer in a factory, but he wore a tie every day to go to work, and I remember for some reason talking about Beatles or the Rolling Stones when I must have been about 7 years old on the stairwell and with my dad at the house and saying, I like the Rolling Stones. He said, you can't like the Rolling Stones. You have to like the Beatles.
this is
obviously before the Beatles started taking drugs publicly. And Mark Bolan was pretty much my first proper single, Hot Love. And watching him, and of course he beat Bowie to glam, didn't he? He beat Bowie to the glitter, and when he wore the glitter on his cheeks. Now, remind me, who they were at a party, weren't they, Bowie and Bolan? And some woman put
Chalita. Tony Secunda's wife, in a moment of spontaneity, glued a bit of glitter to his cheeks. I think it was before Hot Love,
T-Rex
played Hot Love on the Pops.
It was.
And that was sort of the birth of...
The birth of glitter rock.
Glitter rock.
Which is glam. And of course, then it's all tied in with those shops, you know, Mr. Freedom and wherever they got their gear. So it was glam rock, and it was Roxy Music. And it was, and I suppose that was my benchmark and was what we, all of my generation, referred to post-punk when it was our turn to get into doing our own thing. In the meantime, before then, I did go via prog rock. I did go via Genesis. Actually, you know, when you think about it, you know, Peter Gabriel dressed like a flower or a fox isn't far away from glam rock. It's all theatre, right? I mean, Supper's Ready was one of my great records, you know. I'd lie on the floor and listen to Supper's Ready one day, and another day I'd lie on the floor in the dark listening to Time, you know, equally as theatrical.
Yes.
Off of Aladdin Sane album.
With expensive headphones?
No, with my stereo turned up if my mum and dad had gone out.
Right.
I don't think I had any headphones then. But it was, you know, so via Pink Floyd and all of those, you know, whatever it was, you know, and of course punk. And then when it came to the New Romantic idea, or whatever it got called New Romantic, we'll discuss that. It was, you know, glam was every, Bowie was everybody's reference point.
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting, before we started, we were talking about how the massive age difference, 3 or 4 years, is when you're 17, 16, whatever. And I was kind of slightly too old for glam. You know, I mean, I did love Bowie and I did love Mark Bolan. But it wasn't my tribe, you know. It was very much your tribe.
Well, I tell you what it is, and it's a pubescent boy,
yes.
And I felt it in my loins.
I'm not sure what to hear about.
I do think this is
it's
it.
It's a family show.
Yes. But I do think this is it. That's that. Whatever music affects you at that age, 13.
Is
entwined with sexuality,
yes.
and Bowie was, he was a genius at that. And of course Bowie had this great charisma, didn't he, because he could charm record companies into, you know, once they dropped him for not selling records, he'd charm another one into signing him, and another one into signing him.
Out of interest, I mean, what was your relationship with black music as a teenager?
Tamla Motown
would
have been some of the singles I bought, you know, like it would have been Stone Love or Four Tops would have been in there. I mean, you know, there would have been those kind of early records.
The reason I ask is that your band's roots were heavily in black music.
I think black music, for me, probably dance music came a bit later, so that would have been 77, 78, you know, there was a record shop called Contempo, which was just off of Oxford Street and Hallam Street. Well, funnily enough, we did some of our first rehearsals as
Blues
a band.
And Soul, Blues and Soul was above it, John Abbey and all
and
that.
On a Saturday, you know, when I wasn't doing my Saturday job to earn some money, or, you know, or a day off, you know, kids would go to that shop, dress up, go to the shop, stand outside, because it was packed inside, listening to the one or two copies they had of some import.
Right,
And take it, you know, me, I want to buy that. You know, coming home with Do What You Want to Do or something,
That was that's interesting.
Casablanca label or something.
Yeah.
I mean, so you obviously talk about Bowie, and my experience is exactly the same. Top of the Pops, Bowie and Bolan and so forth. That opened, like, the floodgates to all of it for me. But would it be, I mean, people obviously talk about Blitz all the time now. It's sort of enshrined in kind of popular
culture. It's funny, because my parents had a Blitz.
But I was going to ask you about Billy's, because Billy's doesn't get so much attention. Would it be fair to say that what we, you know, we'll come on to discuss as, you know, the New Romantic, Cult with No Name, etc., really the roots of that were in the Bowie nights at Billy's. That's sort of where it all
Well, I had an old from. I had an older friend, Steve Dagger, who was managing us as a band, you know, and, you know, he was the one who first showed me the flyer to go to Screen on the Green when I was 16, and we saw the Sex Pistols play.
Yes.
You know, that definitely changed everything for me. But then he was the one who appeared with the flyer saying, and the flyer said something like, "Jump aboard the night train, Billy's Bowie night." And it was a Tuesday, and I remember going to this place, and he said, you want to wear something cool, you know. And so I was, we used to buy clothes, Soul Boy clothes from Woodhouse at that time, and you know, like a waistcoat or something.
Yeah.
We went to Soho, and I remember seeing this Cossack with a quiff.
An actual Cossack.
Well, it was Steve Strange. He had a Welsh accent. Right? Yeah, and standing outside the door of this club just in Soho somewhere, and a little Mead Street. This club, by the way, was the Gargoyle Club,
downstairs in the basement?
It was in the basement. Yeah. It's now the kitchens of Soho House, yes, like everything else is. I think my house is virtually going to be...
We're actually sitting in
eventually
the kitchen.
We will all be part of Soho House. And I remember him. We queued up, and I was quite scared, and he looked at me, and he went, you know. It was one of those moments, would you let you in? But yeah, he didn't.
So he was the doorman at Billy's as well.
He was the doorman at Billy's, right. You know. He was basically what it was. Billy's is a club on its uppers, not doing very well, just prostitutes hanging out there, and worst night of the week, if it was possible, was a Tuesday. Yeah. And so Steve Strange and Rusty Egan, this Cockney lad who'd just been to Berlin on a kind of like a party trip and had brought back all of this electronica with him, all these records, exactly. Kraftwerk and Nina Hagengener X or whatever it might be, you know, and like Dusseldorf. He was the DJ. It was a Bowie night, so basically it was anything that Bowie validated. So it would be, you know, Iggy Pop would be in there, right. Lou Reed would be in there. There was a few things happening at that time. Don't forget, there was Mute Records, so there'll be Warm Leatherette definitely on. Yep. And, of course, the early Human League, you know, which, you know, they're being boiled. I couldn't put exact date whether that was out at that time, but I'm guessing. Mm. And anyway, it was £3 to get in, and I managed to get past this Cossack with Diamante brooches and God knows where he got his kit from. And you know, there was a little shop called PX just in Covent Garden, which was selling sort of like one-offs that were sort of semi-sci-fi. So you either look like Dan Dare or a Cossack, you know, that was kind of, and there was Soul Boys down there with their wedge haircuts. So it was a very arty place, and I remember going down these stairs with a throb of electronica coming out of it, and Rusty in a D-Mob kind of sort of 50s suit with Love and Hate tattooed on his hands, and there were these two boys dancing the slow motion jive together. Wow. And it was incredible. It was mesmerizing. Yeah, but it had a sort of, I tell you what, the other thing that people don't mention, there were two big important films that had arrived. There was Cabaret, and there was also The Night Porter, you know, and there was this kind of frisson, you know, messing about with this kind of Weimar Republic imagery. Yeah. It was also later on there'd be Brideshead Revisited, which seemed to kind of encourage a lot of different, a certain 80s look and a sort of, you know, love of that sort of.
I love the fact that Spandau, the first name of the band, was The Gentry. It was almost a Brideshead.
Well, you know what happened, right? Now, because what's interesting about the Betty Page piece that you sent me to read when she,
the manifesto,
when we first she first interviews us, and she comes up with this phrase, neuromantics, although, you know, there is some argument whether that was the first time it was said, but I want Betty to have that because it was the title of the piece, the neuromantics. I'm not quite sure why she said that. Maybe it was because we were, some of us, wearing sort of 18th century trousers, you know,
like, just like romantic knickerbockers,
We pretended that we'd been born fully formed in the Blitz Club or Billy's, which it wasn't the case. You know, we were a power pop band called The Makers before, called The Roots, called The Cut. We formed post-punk after I'd seen the Sex Pistols in 1976. At school, it was a different bass player. It wasn't with my brother. And then we eventually get rid of my brother. We were kind of chasing Generation X around and making our own pop art T-shirts. And power pop was our thing, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then we got this. We started becoming Soul Boys. And we thought, you know, Soul Boys, this is the thing about Soul Boys. And there was a sort of element of politics about what we did, because Steve Dagger, who was managing us, who was 3 years older than us, was off to LSC. And he was he'd be on picket lines and... And he said, look, the thing is, NME, Melody Maker, Sounds, none of them write about black music unless it's reggae, because reggae is like a hippie music, right? But they won't write about soul music. There's no one writing about disco. Why? Because it's working class aspirational music. And it's not political in that sense. It's just about fun, dressing up, and spending money. So we should dress as soul boys to piss them all off, because that's who you are. But we couldn't match the music with that. But we called ourselves the gentry because we were saying we're working class elite.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And that, I think, morphed itself quite easily. When we went to that Billy's Club night, and I went with Dagger and Martin, and Dagger turned to me and said, this is it. These are the people we want to make our band about.
Right, right.
Go and buy a fucking synthesizer.
Yes.
You mentioned that the club that was in the basement on Mead Street, and I have this very vivid... So I was really an outsider looking into that whole thing, but I was going out with a girl who works on Harper's and Queen, and she was very, very interested in sort of street fashion and stuff. So I remember her taking me into the Blitz one night.
And Billy's moved to the Blitz on a Tuesday night. Yeah.
Billy's moved to the... Right. But also back at that... Yeah, so Blitz, the Covent Garden venue... And I just remember feeling like a total fish out of water. I also remember going down to whatever that club then became down in the basement and hearing, to cut a long story short the first time, and thinking, wow, this is great. This is, you know, this new kind of electronic dance pop that we were starting to be sort of aware of and set almost like a template for the sound of early 80s British pop, I think, that record, in so many ways. You know, Tony's the vocal style and just that synth riff. I mean, it was a very...
I think there was something garagey about it.
It wasn't overproduced.
I mean, when Duran came along, there was a lot more production going on in their records.
Which, obviously, we
ended up being highly produced.
Sure.
But in those days, I think there was, you know, Richard James Burgess wanted to just, you know, let's just strip record you as you are.
This
is a great live band as a real film. It's funny me being here because, you know, in the sort of, you know, the centre of rock journalism, you know,
the cathedral of music.
Because the one thing, for some reason, we set up the Rock Press as our nemesis.
Cool.
It was part of our conceit, really, that all rock journalists were middle class, had the wrong view of the working classes. I think we'd learned a bit from Malcolm McLaren. You have to have an enemy, right? And we decided our enemy would be the Rock Press.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they didn't get us. They didn't get proper working class kids. They thought punk was working class, and it wasn't. It was manufactured by Vivian Westwood and Malcolm McLaren. They were a boy band, you know. And they wore hugely expensive clothes, you know.
Right.
You know, soul and disco and what we are, that's proper working class, and you won't write about it. So no journalists were allowed into the gigs. Right?
Only hairdressers and designers.
And it's interesting. But when we say only hairdressers and designers, that's true. They were working class kids who wanted to somehow be in the arts, right? And a lot of St. Martin's students, they weren't all working class, of course not, but there was such a diverse mix. This was, you know, diverse in class, diverse in sexuality, total fluidity, you know, although it never had a name then, you know. Certain very macho lads I know now had relationships they don't like to mention anymore back in those days. But for some reason, we decided that we would tell everyone that we'd created Spandau Ballet within Billy's and Blitz nightclub.
Yeah.
And we never existed ever as a band before, because being in a band didn't really occur to us.
No, bands were passe.
Yeah. And what's interesting reading that piece as well is it reminded me of how terrified I used to be when journalists arrived, because this journalist was the only window that was going to allow the outside world, the other kids that you were trying to get to.
Sure.
It was the access, the only portal.
Yes.
People don't think about that now, because they can write whatever they want on their websites, on their Instagram pages, etc., about themselves and promote themselves. So journalists, when they come to do that, and they're probably going to be friends. And I had always admired certain journalists. Certain journalists were my portal, you know. So it was Charles Charles Murray. You know, I mean, Charles was my go-to in the NME for Bowie.
He was the number one Bowie.
And maybe it was, and it was Nick Kent, and it was Tony Parsons, you know. So it was terrifying. And you tried to say things that were outrageous. You wanted to say something that was going to get quoted, that was gnarly. And then, of course, when you read it later, it never quite came out with the tone of voice you'd had.
You know. Sure, sure. It's interesting, there's that tension between, on the one hand, making the rock press your enemy, on the other hand, kind of needing and wanting to get some validation in some respects from that and kind of get into...
I think we'd pretty much written off getting a... from what we called the black and white inky press at that time. And I think it was definitely that we knew a change was coming. Yeah. We knew it was going to go into the face and into colour and into... And, of course, our first review, we Steve Dagger stood over Robert Elms while he wrote the review of us at I don't know, I think it was the... It might have been the Blitz, right? I remember somewhere. And who took it into the enemy and managed to get past Danny Baker, who was on reception... and got the thing published.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Vincent, can you remember your very first TV?
Well, the first TV was...
Janet Street.
That's what I was wondering
about. Janet had done this great documentary. She had this programme called 20th Century Box, which went out on a Sunday afternoon, which was pre-Channel 4 youth programme.
Right.
And was it Channel 4? Maybe, no, it wasn't. It was BBC, ITV, London Weekend Television.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd done the Sex Pistols, and that really sort of transformed that. Them, and then she came and asked, and she said, "Oh, I love your scene. Can you, you know, is there any chance of doing a documentary about you guys? You know?" And it was really about our scene, you know. And so, you know, it wasn't just about the band. And I think that really.
No, see, I saw that probably before I read a word about you in the press. Actually, I wasn't a sounds reader. I wouldn't have read Betty Page's thing. So that Janet Street Porter thing was actually the very first time I became aware of you at all.
Yeah. It's very funny now. You know, we're roadieing our own gear, you know, and going to a proper, you know, and it's very, very low rent. That's actually what is so nice about it, looking back on it. Except, you know, and then you see Robert Elms and I think Sade's in it. I don't know, but she's not Sade then. She's not a singer. I don't know. Robert Elms is in it. And he goes down to, there was a shop called Modern Classics that Willie Brown, in the then rather unfashionable Shoreditch or Hoxton, was tailoring weird stuff, and we all liked it, and we all bought that kind of work clothes, which I love that phrase, don't you, work? I've never done a day's work in my life. And you know, but you need work clothes for coffee bars, don't you? And you know, it's a real little snapshot, timepiece of that sort of really tired London late 70s, but kids striving to do something that is just unconventional, arty, you know, not dressing like their dads, you know, but also rather different to everything from the older brother's generation had done, you know.
TV was interesting those days because there wasn't a lot of it.
No.
But if a band was on TV, a lot of people saw it. So it was actually quite a good introduction to quite a wide audience. The first time I became aware of Joy Division, for example, was in So It Goes, Tony Wilson's.
That's right. Yeah.
And they were, for me, memorable events, seeing bands for
the
very
first time. Well,
of course,
the Pistols were on that as well, weren't
they? Yeah. Oh, I saw the Pistols at my art school in 75, but that's a different, tedious story. But I do remember these certain key programmes, and it was never the old grey whistle test. It was never that. It was these odd marginal programmes which were slotted in on a weekend afternoon or something like Janet Street Porter, like So It Goes.
Yes, be
like,
very important.
You know, and seeing bands who...
This is what we're, you know, what we're all in agreement on is the mystique that you could build with such little access to the audience, right?
Yeah.
So
you
know, if Spandau Ballet were playing at the Blitz now, where a place where we weren't just selling tickets on the door, we were just basically playing to friends, and you know, someone would have got in with a phone, put it up on YouTube, and someone would have written bollocks underneath, right? And then it'd be over, you know. So, but you could build up this sort of like really this fast train of mystique that people were all trying to jump on and catch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you played the music press and you played the TV slots you got.
I love that Betty Page sounds piece because you do really get a sense of that scene of that. And then you talk about the HMS Belfast gig that you did, and you say it was a shame more couldn't come, but space was limited. There was no need to advertise. Those who wanted to go already knew about it, which I think really speaks to that thing of like, well, if you were in it, you were in it, and you didn't need a big advertising budget or anything like that because you just had that kind of groundswell of sort of
I think, I mean, I was obviously defending some of the accusations against us being elitist and not allowing regular, because we didn't advertise in the back of the NME, and along, you know, supporting Mean Streets or whatever it was. And so it was, you know, we were trying to play unconventional places, and we had a ready-made audience, and building the buzz and
would
not allowing record companies.
You had learnt from Malcolm McLaren the way that was settled.
100%. Yeah. You know, McLaren was the blueprint.
Yeah.
Although we wouldn't have admitted it at the time. In fact, I think in one of those articles, we slag them all off, don't we?
And of course.
Slag off Julie Birchall. I love Steve Dagger says something about she bought one soul record. I don't know what one he means. He means Evelyn Champagne King's Shame.
Because, I mean, you said about going to the Screen on the Green Pistols gig. That's exactly a mirror image of what you're talking about. So a very exclusive show, just to the people who know about it, sort of thing.
Well, I think people forget what that gig was like, actually. Because there's no footage of it, there's some film of it, and there's this recording. Everyone was sitting down. There were the Bromley contingent were down the front. Mm. Most of them were sitting down, calling names to Johnny. You're crap. What are you doing? This is rubbish. It's all part of the game.
Yes.
And then I think there was Philip Saddle?
Salon.
Sorry, my brain was going then. Thank you. 63.
Together we can, Karen.
Thank you. Philip Salon jumps on stage. The first time I'd ever seen Philip Salon, and he was wearing a sort of a char ladies kind of coat, you know.
Yeah.
And he started doing a bit of dancing. But I remember Steve Dagger, who I went with, he went off to the loo while the Clash had just finished. Buzzcocks had been on with Howard Devoto. He went off to the loo. As the Sex Pistols were coming on, he didn't realise. And all of a sudden, Johnny Rotten burst into the loo next to him and went, "I'll just knock my fucking tooth out on the mic." And I've never seen him doing it.
Wow.
But it was very sort of low-key gig, but it was extraordinary. The Clash were extraordinary, and that sort of, you know, legs akimbo, sort of like paint-splattered boiler suits. That was. So I went straight. I was in a band already, and I went much older people doing kind of, I don't know, sort of jazz, funk, country, God knows, anything they wanted to do. I was just playing guitar. And then I went straight into rehearsals on the following day and said, I'm quitting. And then we all formed our band.
Yeah. I like the fact that you guys observed the way he did certain things about the sort of the semi-private gigs, the small scene thing, and just took it a step further. And you're right, I think it's a shame it's really hard to do now. You know, that the ability to grow a scene... It's very, very hard.
I wonder when the last one was. You know, I'm thinking back to the Libertines. I remember there was a big scene around them with Kate Moss and all her crew turning up. Maybe the Arctic Monkeys might have had a...
Their
scene was MySpace, wasn't it? Arctic Monkeys.
They were the first internet band. Yeah.
There is a London jazz scene, actually, but a different feeling scene. I mean scene because it's people that go, you know, steam down on a Wednesday night, and it's like there is a kind of feeling to the whole thing.
I completely accept that. The thing is, it's never going to go much beyond that scene by the nature of the music that's been played.
That's not true, though.
What's different here is about popular music.
No, but this is becoming popular music. The comet is coming. You know, that kind of that kind of jazz. I think is. I mean, it's not. You know, it's.
They have been saying this for 60 years, though. There's never been another Acca Bilk.
No, what I mean is just that it's a young black.
Yeah, no, there is. But the music is maybe the music is. Well, it's hard to say. Is the music too complex? Because look what happened to prog rock.
I don't think so, because it's, you know, if you look at musicians like Little Sims and, you know, the kind of the mixture of
putting that in the back,
you know, hip hop and jazz now, I think there is more of
I still think it's just much harder to create a scene of that sort than it was back then.
Well, a scene that's going to really go overground.
Yeah. Well, there's not any such thing as like the mainstream pop press anymore. So people are much more free to just pursue what they're interested in without there having to be a kind of major.
No, but
scene.
If you're trying to build the talk of the town, right? That's from any manager's point of view or any artist's point of view. That's a tough thing.
It's a tough gig.
Yeah, like, you know, because my son works in the record business, you know, and it's access to everybody, and they come and they go. you know, there are five big bands out there and no one can budge them, you know. And anyway, it's so funny, isn't it? Because I remember seeing that gig, the one where I was just talking about, and Joe Strummer would sang No Elvis Beatles or the Rolling Stones. And of course, here we are, the Rolling Stones are still on the tour. The Beatles we all still love, and Elvis the same.
Well, talk about like sort of scenes exploding. I mean, did you, when you look back now, how do you remember groups like Spandau, and for that matter, like Duran Duran, other Depeche Mode? I mean, I saw early Depeche Mode.
Yeah, I went down to Basel and saw Croc.
Did you see them in Basel? These acts became the sort of defining British pop acts of the early 90s and had hits in America, and we had Boy George and Annie Lennox were on the cover of Newsweek. And I mean, how do you remember that? How did your ambitions grow as Spandau? How did you get from Journeys to Glory to True and Gold?
Well, you know what, I think a lot of it was to do with when it happened. So that we felt a responsibility to the decade, right? It felt like the future, because everything seemed to have happened in the, you know, the Beatles had split up before I bought my first record, but everything seemed to have happened in that decade, the 70s. So the 80s, this was us. Yeah. We had to do this, and we had to do it differently. And technology was changing. The synthesizer was much more accessible. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking about digital. We were, you know, things were going colour. You know, the CD was invented and sound, you know, I mean, you're just
there's a
there
massive change.
I can hear someone breathing. It's amazing.
Yeah, it almost felt like you were in a completely different world in the 80s, which is when I started writing about music. And it was, I felt somewhat at sea because I still, in a way, stuck in the 70s, you know, in Bowie and, I mean, you know, Todd Rundgren and things like that. I mean, the band, and I sort of still, my heart, and in a way, my heart still is in the 70s, because that was when I was, you know, growing up as a music consumer. And the 80s, I felt a little estranged by.
There was you've written definitive books on the subject.
There was a sort of slightly roundhead cavalier thing around kind of new romanticism.
Yes.
And, right. And I mean, I certainly was probably more in the roundhead camp, you know, and not that I was like, you should be wearing raincoats and you shouldn't be so flamboyant, but I was slightly scared of fashion.
Well, it's
that's
funny.
When I went into Blitz, I was like, oh, fuck, I'm going to be thrown out.
Well, it's funny because in one of those pieces, Steve Dagger's being interviewed, and it's like it's me and Steve Dagger being interviewed, it's me and the manager being interviewed. It's so weird, isn't it?
It's
and
great,
Steve
great
says something, oh, I hate the grey bands, you know. And I know he's talking about Echo and the Bunnymen, he's talking about shoegazing,
and he slags off orange juice in a certain ratio. It's so boring.
It's a couple of weeks ago, someone printed the Enemy Staff Choices of the Singles of 1981. And it's just the most astonishing list of staff, you know.
Incredible,
and it's got, like, Grace Jones, Private Lives, things like that, you know. Yeah. You've got that sort of stuff in there. You've got Kid Creole and the Coconuts in
Joseph
there.
Joseph Kay. You've got a really interesting indie
stuff's
band.
Coming over from New York. The whole No Wave sort of thing was really, for me, was personally really exciting, you know.
James White and the Blacks. We have been
all of that sort of stuff, you know, and Defunct. Every time I came over to England, I was down the front, you know. But what a great list it was. You've got Night Nurse by Gregory Isaacs. You know,
there's a lot of great music.
I think, actually, in some ways, 1979 to 1982 was on the most exciting stretch for British popular music, you know. Mm-hmm. And there was so much brilliant stuff happening. And so a lot of people were inventing their 1980s.
Yeah,
you know? I think one of the keys for us and for all those bands you just mentioned and the success abroad and globally was we wanted that.
We didn't want
to be indie.
Yeah.
You know, we I'd grown up buying singles. I'd grown up sitting in the quad playground, you know, with the transistor radio that we were all sharing, listening for the charts to see who gets the number
one. You listen on a Sunday night, the countdown.
The charts
glued to the
were
radio.
Music premiership.
Yes.
Table.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So I wanted to be that person with singles, you know, selling singles. And I think that ambition happened at the same time as MTV came along. So you had MTV, you had good-looking bands, young kids who wanted to look good, wanted to dress up, and, you know, that marriage of things are always relying on mediums, right? You know, so what is whatever art relies on medium? You know, the reason the album is as we know it is that 20 minutes of vinyl. fitted a movement of a symphony.
You know? But there's other interesting things. It's like, you know, Scritti Politica could go from Skank Block Bologna to The Sweetest Girl. Mm. That in itself is the same thing. It's
and
like,
then to working with Arif Mardin in New York.
So it's really
interesting.
It's not good enough to be a scratchy post-punk band playing the Acklam Hall. You want to make A, things of beauty.
Yeah.
You know, produce really beautiful.
Trevor Horn comes in. And,
you know, well, can we just mention Joy Division? I mean, Love Will Tear Us Apart. You know, that really, you know, a commercial record.
We didn't think of it as at the time.
With an incredible rhythmic engine.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
It steals from The Crystals and then He Kissed Me.
Yes.
There we go.
Punk lasted no time at all. I mean, punk its great years was basically 18 months, you know, pretty much. And then straight after that, 1978, then 79, people trying to find new ways of doing things. In a way, you slot into that. What are new ways of doing things? Is it just like having a monophonic synthesizer? Is it whatever, you know?
Yes.
And so, sort of, 79, 80, 81, 82. It's this extraordinary explosion of creativity goes on.
It really was.
But I think it's that pipeline into America was very important. I remember first touring America.
Right.
And the West Coast, which had MTV, had really got it, and they had K-Rock, and they were playing British records, and the Americans couldn't compete.
Partly because the British were the only people making videos.
They were.
At that time.
It was Bruce Springsteen had his arm broken virtually to make a video, and he did Dancing in the Dark,
and
it changed his career.
Yes.
And,
American suspicion of sort of glamour in a way and exhibitionism.
Ironically, yeah.
Well, it all comes back to, I mean, one of the great quotes in that Betty Page pieces, I don't think they, as in the music press, liked the idea of dressing up for some reason. They didn't like the idea of fashion as a progressive force, but it's nothing to be ashamed of.
That's Steve Dagger.
And fashion as a progressive force, I think, is a really interesting concept. Mm-hmm. And again, we're using words like flamboyance, and we're using words like, dressing up, all of that stuff. There's a lot about self-expression, a lot about homophobic repression of that kind of self-expression. When you think about drag, you think about New York, you think about that whole...
No, we were trying to break out of that.
Exactly, right. Exactly. And
so I think you're right, and I think this is quite an important thing to say, that we were pro the dressing up because we saw it as a political statement.
Yes.
So we'd say, in our very sort of like simple way, that middle class people, upper class, well, middle class people, the intelligentsia, they had their books on their shelves.
The metropolitan elite.
The metropolitan elite, which of course I am now.
Which you now embody.
But they may have letters after their name. What we have is ourselves as our canvas. Yes. Mm. And when we walk out into the street, because nowadays everyone has a profile on, Instagram or Facebook, and they can show what they look like. In those days, you had to walk out.
Yeah, yeah.
It was all about place.
Yes.
And it was all about destination. Mm. Where is the place that it will happen?
Mm.
And this is interesting because this will tie in to our little chat on Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
Because there is a complete similarity between how Pink Floyd started and how Spandau Ballet started. And it's like a quarter of a mile.
Mm.
And, we start in this little club that is the most happening place in London in 1978-79. They start 12 years before that in the most happening club in London at the UFO Club.
Yeah.
And they became the house band. There was a history. We knew about that.
You're
at the
right.
time. There was a history of this happening, whether it was, over at the railway Tavern Hotel or whatever with that scene mm-hmm. going on, or whether it was, at the UFO Club, or whether it was at Middle Earth with Tyrannosaurus Rex and Bowie to a certain extent, whether it was maybe at the Roxy, so this, we thought the Blitz, Billy's, this is the new place, it needs a house band.
Right.
Yes, exactly. You've done what we always have to do ourselves, which is you've segued to the next subject. So grateful to you. My segue was going to be, if someone had come up to you when you were like queuing to get into Billy's, or even a little bit later into Blitz, and said, one day, Gary Kemp, you will be playing with Nick Mason of Pink Floyd, what would your response have been?
Yeah, well...
Fuck off, mate. No fucking way.
No way. No,
yeah,
way.
That's the truth. Well, you had to say that.
My
right?
response to Betty Page would have been one thing, right? But my inner child would
the
have
real.
Been buzzing because, you know.
The prog child inside.
Yeah, you know, I went to see Floyd at Wembley Arena, whatever it was called in those
Empire,
days.
Empire Pool.
In 1974, 75.
Right.
I went to the Dark Side of the Moon tour, where they also, I think in the first half, presented what was going to become the Wish You Were Here album, which was, and I remember clearly Shine On You Crazy Diamond, because it was one of the most incredible pieces of music.
I would say personally it's the best song Pink Floyd ever made.
Apart from Old Lane.
No, better than.
And of course, you've got to remember it, because if you listen back to those tapes now, because they're out there in the world, some of what they did didn't end up on Wish You Were Here. It ended up on Animals.
Right.
Raving and Drooling ended up as one of those tracks on Animals. I'm sorry, Pink Floyd geeks, you know what track I'm talking about. I can't name it. But you get the... So I remember clearly being on a summer holiday in Poole, Bournemouth, staying at my mum and dad's friend's house, and their oldest son having Dark Side of the Moon and me playing it over and over, asking him, Steve, please play that record again, play that record again. And couldn't wait to go back to school. So I would have been 13.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't wait to go back to school in the September to tell everyone that this is the album of the year. So we were having discussions earlier about how much you do or don't like Dark Side of the Moon. But I had no bias. I knew nothing about Pink Floyd. Absolutely nothing. And then I heard this record, and I fell through the gaps in the music. That's how it felt to mm-hmm. me. The space they allowed, it was quite... I could understand it. It wasn't like prog rock, which was complex and Bachian and cathedral-like. I understood this because it was blues-based,
yeah,
song-based, but it was that...
The ambient. It was very ambient.
Gorgeous space in the record.
Before ambient music.
Extraordinary production. Yeah. I mean, whether you love Pink Floyd or not, for the time, it was
amazing.
Quite extraordinary.
Yeah, and also, this is very clever, this conceptual thing,
you know,
because really the album's not very... It doesn't have a storyline, it doesn't have a through line. Neither really does Ziggy Stardust, you know, as much as people rant on about that.
True.
But what humans love to do is join lines between disparate things. That's why we're great conspiracy theorists, aren't we?
Yeah.
So someone tells us, someone joins the tracks together and tells us there's some kind of concept there. We'll be looking for any little line we can draw and find, and people are still doing that.
I mean, in a sense, what went wrong with Pink Floyd is then they discovered that...
They made too much money?
Well, no, I mean, The Wall is the direct byproduct of them actually deciding that we will be conceptual in a real sense. You know, the as you say, with Dark Side of the Moon, it's accidental. It's how we perceive that album as being a coherent piece in that sort of concept album respect. But it told them that that's what they should do. And certainly Roger Waters started pursuing that.
Yeah, I think lyrically, Roger Waters pursued that and pursued a lot of self-obsession about being a rock star. And, you know, but they were always hugely experimental.
Yeah, from the very start.
And we have to go, you know, to thank Sid for so much. He's even after he left, the reverberating down the history of Pink Floyd, his presence.
Yeah.
Well, so to any listeners who aren't aware of this, you know, Gary has been now for, well, six years almost, playing as...
We had a COVID gap.
There was a COVID gap, playing with Pink Floyd drummer Nick Mason in Saucerful of Secrets. But one of the reasons we wanted to invite you in for this episode was because of the 50th anniversary of Dark Side of the Moon. But let's just talk a bit about Saucerful and the fact that you, as a group, made this decision to focus on early Floyd and sort of Sid's Floyd in many ways.
We did the first five albums.
You did the first five albums. But initially it was like, let's go, I mean, go back and look at those
songs. Go back to UFO.
Go back to UFO. So how did it come about? I mean, so we've got three Pink Floyd pieces that went in. The last of them is an interview with Nick from July 2018. And I think you've either just played the first two or three shows, like Dingwalls and so forth.
Yes.
You're about to, or you've just played them. And Nick talks about how he doesn't want this to be well, a Pink Floyd tribute band, yeah, like the Australian Pink Floyd. So, what was the first junior? Was it Guy, who had played in various Pink Floyd tribute bands, reaching out to you?
Guy would have called me first. But what happened was Lee Harris, who had played guitar with the Blockheads,
yes,
post Ian Drury, had seen Guy playing with David Gilmour down in France, where Lee lives. And was really buzzed by it. This is incredible. And then he thinks about it and he thinks, why doesn't Nick go out and do anything? Why doesn't Nick go out? And how would we approach that? Maybe it's just the... I'm sure it was Lee's idea who thought about doing the early stuff. I think what the reason for that is everything after Medal is Imperial Floyd. It's done endlessly, yeah, but it has to be done like a fly dentist would approach it.
Right.
In great detail and microscopic.
Yeah.
And all the solos become very purple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are like Shakespearean soliloquies. And you have to get them exactly right.
Right.
And all those people, even ones who go out with Roger and... the guitarists that play with Roger and the guitarists and all the, of course, all the tribute bands, they all emulate the sound. And Guy called me and he said, you know, I don't know, because he'd already met with Nick then, because Lee and Guy go... Guy sends Nick this one page that Lee had written out with the idea. And he thought, you know, this will just be a nice lunch with Nick, because he's always worth a nice lunch. And I knew Nick anyway.
Right.
And Nick quite liked the idea. He thought it was quite good. And he threw the idea in of me playing guitar because we were friends. And Guy was, you know, was one of my oldest friends. And so Guy gave me a call and he said, look, you know, this is the idea. We went into rehearsals tentatively. Nick wouldn't bring any of his drum kit. He rented the tiniest kit you could find. It was a room not much bigger than the one we're sitting in now. Very small room, smallest rehearsal room that Nick could find. I think he just wanted a bit, really get back to the sort of like, you know, he was fed up with all the equipment and everything, you know. I mean, it's like they build a city when they rehearse for Pink Floyd in those days. And the first songs we tried out were almost certainly Arnold Lane, were Interstellar Overdrive and Set the Controls for Heart of Sun. We all looked at Nick and he went, same time tomorrow? And we thought, oh, nice. This is going to go well.
Yeah, nice.
I have to say that the first early Floyd I ever heard was See Emily Play, and it was by Bowie.
Right.
On
Pin-Up.
Okay. Yes.
I never really... Yeah, and then Relics came about post-Dark Side, right? We all bought Relics, and then we all heard all the other stuff, and then I got into everything.
Yeah.
But that first tour, we never did Echoes. Echoes was the bridge to Imperial Floyd. In fact, it was the first one, really.
Yes.
And I think everyone was a bit tentative and we shouldn't be treading on anyone's toes. Maybe Echoes isn't right. And David had said that he didn't want to play Echoes again. And Guy had after Rick had died, because he said it was a conversation between him and Rick. And understandably, Guy was feeling loyal to David and wasn't sure about doing Echoes. And Echoes is something we felt strongly about doing in the end because Nick co-wrote that.
Yeah.
This is, you know, as important to him as it is to anyone still living in that band. I think we did a fantastic job of it. But it was our second tour that we really put that one together.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a tribute band. It's not a tribute band because of two things. One, Nick is in the band. And this is the most interesting Nick stuff, don't forget. You know, this is when he's using his mallets. You know, just watch the Pompeii film. You know, he plays so much more stuff, more jazz-orientated than he did later on in post-Dark Side. And also because Nick said, we want to make this all our own. You don't have to do exactly what David plays here. You don't have to sing this. We don't have to get that keyboard. Let's make this band, you know, explore the music of Pink Floyd. So we did that.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Great. Set the controls for the heart of the sun.
You mentioned Rick, the week's new audio interview on RBP is one we've dug up with Rick Wright.
Do
you want to tell us about
that? Yeah, it's Jim Sullivan, a phoner, Jim Sullivan, who wrote for the Boston Globe. Rick's done a solo album called Broken China, which I have to say I inflicted on myself yesterday. not an experience I'd like to repeat. But it's about, I mean, it's very interesting. It's a very dark album about his wife's depression, which is not something one would normally sort of jollily write. In fact, I think Jim Sullivan's first thing is, well, I heard your jaunty album. You know, it's kind of slightly sarcastically. And he talks about melancholia in his music and melancholia in Pink Floyd's music. That's all fine. He talks about, even though it's about his wife's depression, he had a lyricist write the lyrics, which I find fairly kind of mind-bending in itself. Sinead O'Connor sings on it and talks about himself becoming a singer, which if you listen to the album, one could have certain doubts about. But then the question is, what's up with the Floyd? And he says, well, we haven't got any immediate plans to tour this year. And it turns out they didn't tour for another 4 years or something. Like, you know, there was a big, big gap. Because this is 97, it's January 97. And then he talks about his...
But of course, I mean, I just want to say, in Rick's defence, as a singer, I mean, that's, you know, there's some... The echoes, and you know, he sings on that.
He talks about being very self-conscious and actually relaxing into the act of singing again, because he probably hadn't done it for a long time by this 97. Anyway, then he talks about his dismissal from Floyd, Roger Waters, doing the Wall, Roger saying, if you're not going to contribute anything to this, we want you out of the band, and him basically dragooning him out of the band. Let's have a listen to this clip.
It was fucking awful.
Yeah.
It was, I have to say, I've always had to, I think everyone knows, but I mean, it was a terrible time.
Yeah.
And it was basically, I didn't have much option but to agree to leave for various reasons. And, but it was bad, and it certainly affected me. Yeah. Looking back now, it did affect me quite deeply.
Yeah.
And because I look at the period of my life after the Wall, where I'd attempted to do an album with someone else called Identity, which was really a mistake because I wasn't really there.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't suffering clinical depression, but I would say I was depressed.
Right, sure.
And therefore had no energy to put into music. And however, you know the story, then I kind of rejoined, well, I went on the road with Dave and Nick for a Momentary Lapse.
Right.
And from there, everything came back.
Then you were a part of the band again.
And then, yes,
right.
That tour was very important. Because by that time, Dave and Nick, as you know, I'm sure,
were
huge fights with Roger.
Yes, of course.
we won't get into the fights with Roger.
Actually, I don't know why not, because I mean, half of my pleasure as Rock's Back Pages is finding another interview with Dave Gilmour, where in the most... clips. I mean, basically, Dave Gilmour is now like a retired lieutenant colonel from the British Army. And with this extraordinary restrained, posh restraint, he's so rude about Roger Waters. But it's all done with this extraordinary British restraint, you know. It's,
I have to be careful because they're friends of mine. But,
yes.
What I will say is Rick's tenderness really shines through in the Floyd catalogue.
Right.
If you take something from the early days, which we do live, which is the Source of the Secrets, and, you know, which is an extraordinary piece of music, because it starts off with chaos, and then these incredible chord sequence comes out, I think it's something like 12 chords, different chords, back to back. You know, it's a beautiful chord sequence that comes out of that. I enjoy that whenever we play it. Later on, I mean, let's take Dark Side. We were talking about Dark Side. So Us and Them, you know, and people do seem to think, oh, yeah, it was Roger's record song, Roger's... You know, Us and Them comes from an instrumental piece of music that's on the Zabriskie Point soundtrack called... Which got dropped, actually, from the Zabriskie Point soundtrack, got dropped. You can find it if you go on YouTube. And it's called The Violent Sequence. The Violent Sequence. And it's Us and Them instrumentally. And that's when Roger went and wrote lyrics on top of that.
Right.
And of course, then we've got Great Gig in the Sky, which is one of the most extraordinary.
That's really good.
So I think he did have a very unique style, and he pushed the influence of his music into that band.
Yeah,
and there's, you know, so when people highlight David and Roger, It's not really
I have to get it. And actually, in this interview, he says the dispute starts because Rick hasn't brought anything to the table for the new record they're going to make, which came with The Wall. And Roger's very angry that Rick hadn't produced anything, and that was his what started the ball rolling. But it was interesting that about him not producing anything, and that goes exactly towards what you're saying, that he was an important contributor musically to the band before then. Yes. So anyway, so they go through that. Then the last bit we'll listen to this clip is about the current state of Syd Barrett.
It's the same as it's always been since he left the band back in 68. Yeah. Nothing has changed. It's very sad.
I did hear he was in the hospital, I guess. Is that right?
I believe he's now going to hospital because he's diabetic.
Uh-huh.
And I think they say he's possibly going blind slowly.
Yeah.
So it's very, very sad. There's not much more I can say.
You're not in touch at all?
No.
Okay.
I know, would add that we're not in touch because we've been asked not to get in touch by his doctors.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Because it doesn't help him.
Because you remind him of what he had?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You remind him of what was, and he still remembers.
Does it? Yeah. Yeah.
And puts him into deep depression.
Yeah, okay, I can see
and
that.
And so we have actually been asked, sort of, there's nothing you can do, and it doesn't help to actually speak to him or see him.
Oh, that's sad.
Which is very difficult for us, but we just respect the doctors.
And sure.
And his mother said that too.
Now, his mother died, I think,
yes,
didn't she?
Did.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
Fine. Okay.
But the word is that he's, you know, he's comfortably off.
Mm-hmm.
He's generally happy in his own little world.
Yeah, right.
So,
right.
I mean, he's not suffering, which is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Financially or emotionally. He's basically happy.
Right. Remember when you were young? You shone like the sun.
Does that make sense to you, Gary?
Well, I mean, obviously, he'd blown his mind out a long time ago, and you know, Nick has told me the stories of Syd and how, you know, he just became someone they didn't know very, very quickly in those early days, you know, when they obviously called up Gilmore and got help from him. But
Nick talks quite a lot in what you've done, two Rock on Tours episodes with Nick. The first one was with Nick, wasn't it? And I can't remember which one. I think it's the first one you talk about Syd and acid and the amount of acid he took.
The type of acid.
Yeah, no, obviously, it's not just about the acid. It was the guy who was obviously, you know, wasn't the sort of person who should be taking that.
Yeah.
You know, there's that extraordinary story, isn't there, where Syd, well, they're recording Wish You Were Here, and I couldn't tell you what studio that was in.
Abbey Road?
Let's say Abbey Road. Oh. And there was a guy appears hanging around, a large man, bald head, and people thought, oh, he just works at the studio. In fact, Pink Floyd, they think this guy just works at the studio. Nick says that he suddenly realised who it was.
Right.
And he said to David, it's Syd.
Yeah, yeah.
And Syd was sitting there while they are recording Shine On You Crazy Diamond.
That's that particular song, which is about him.
Yeah, about him, exactly. Yeah. And there's that wonderful moment at the end of the final part of Shining New Crazy Diamond, where as the track is fading out, you hear Rick play on the synthesizer the melody to See Emily Play. When we first approached all that early music, he realised what an extraordinary pop songwriter he was for a start. You know, Arnold Lane is just a, you know, fantastic song about cross-dressing and
prefiguring the new romantic movement,
and obviously see Emmy playing the whole psychedelic stuff. But what else, the other thing was what they were doing on something like Interstellar Overdrive, which was jazz based, if you like. It has this big riff at the beginning and then it's total atonal freeform. There's a fantastic footage, I think, somewhere out there where Frank Zappa's playing it with them, and then it eventually comes back to, this is obviously pre-David, comes back to the riff, and when you get to the riff, it's like that's the relief, you know, the release of this moment of recognition and something tuneful. And so when we approached that track, it was great fun to do that, to work out that breakdown, to try and find out how we can still keep people interested with this atonal stuff. you know, but you watch the old footage and you see Sid playing with delay machines, mm-hmm. and he's got the Benson Echo machine in front of him, and he's, and it's all delays, all delays. Well, when David came into the band a little while after that, he had to pretty much emulate what Sid had started in the group. And so the delay, mm-hmm. and echo that Sid had sort of played with, David takes over. It's David's thing now, you know? It's right. what he does. It's how he, one so, of the so great s- parts s- of his palette.
So Sid's DNA yeah. just carries on through the band's history after his exit.
I think so, because yes. Roger also writes an album all about him, yeah, well, pretty yes. much, you know? And I think there is... To have madness that close, to have your friend turn into someone they didn't recognise so quickly,
yeah.
must have made everyone feel vulnerable. And I think, you know, Roger obviously has written lyrics about yeah. that for many years.
But also, this is 1968-69. People weren't attuned to dealing with mental distress in those days. Mm. You know, we didn't have the armoury that we have, collectively have now. No. You know, so... What was happening to Sid was an absolutely baffling mystery to everyone. You know, if that was to happen to someone now, there would be interventions at a very much earlier stage. You know, the maybe solutions in, you know...
But Sid became a sort of messianic enigma, didn't he, really?
Yeah.
For the band as well as well, for the true. Fans.
Yes. Yeah.
I would have thought, you know, that became part of the inspiration yeah. and part of the religion yeah. of Pink Floyd.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes. We mentioned Rock on Tours, which is a one.
Can I just finish off a
yes.
little bit on this?
Yes, of course.
Because one of the articles you sent me was a review of them doing Dark Side for the yeah. first time.
Yeah, well, I want to... So, you know, well...
There's
two people, including the little interview with Nick that I mentioned earlier. Rather fascinating that we've got these two sort of bookending pieces around Dark Side. One is from a year before the album was released, and one is from a year after... Yeah, both NME pieces. Yeah, yeah. And then the first one, Tony Stewart goes to Brighton Dome to hear the very first performance of
Eclipse.
Yes. Dark Side of the Moon. There are problems with the sound after about half an hour.
Let me just get the right, because it was called Dark Side of the Moon.
It was called Dark Side of the Moon.
And what happened is Medicine Head had an album coming out called Dark Side of the Moon. And they thought, damn, we can't call it Dark Side of the Moon. Let's call it Eclipse, something about lunatics.
Yes.
And then I think probably Medicine Head's album didn't do very well. And they then...
So they got
I liked Medicine Head. I remember buying Medicine Head single.
They were
on the Dandelion label. Yeah, and it was a very nice label.
Yeah.
And of course, if you listen to that first Dark Side of the Moon... Brighton, everyone says, "Oh, they first did Dark Side at Brighton." They actually don't. The plug gets pulled at money because there's some problem with the.
They had a quadraphonic sound system, yeah. which is an absolute nightmare. If this is a live PA, having a quadraphonic PA is really hard work for everyone involved.
And Rick used to operate the sort of zenith control or
to
move things around the room.
Wow,
the zenith control sounds like a Robert Ludlum novel. Zenith control, novel.
Yeah. And anyway, so there was a problem, wasn't there? And the PA started hissing and burping, and it was a horrible. And you can hear this is all on YouTube. Of course.
even things that didn't happen.
And then they all go off and then they wonder what to do and they come back on and do Careful Without Axe Usually.
Right.
And they don't finish Eclipse. The first time Dark Side was ever played was the next night at Portsmouth Guildhall.
Hilarious. Okay. Marvellous.
And is that on YouTube?
I don't think.
And probably the gig after that was probably the Colston Hall Bristol,
we chased this around because we played. We wanted to play Brighton Dome because of that.
We did
that on the last tour, and we played Portsmouth Guildhall twice.
Brighton Dome's a lovely venue as well.
It's beautiful,
really, really good.
Yeah. And that first Dark Side didn't have the On the Run, wasn't on it. If you listen to that, On the Run was only developed in the studio when they got the VS3 synthesizer.
It was
a track called The Travel Sequence, mm-hmm. which is very different. It's kind of based on David's funky guitar part. Right, but right. That was where that was.
What's lovely about the Tony Stewart piece is because he talks about, he says that there's literally still writing bits of Dark Side of the Moon on the bus down to Brighton, you know. So it's all it's all kind of in flux and coming together. But it's a fascinating piece, and there's a great quote from Nick saying, you know, how excited he is. He feels excited for the first time in a while, because, you know, As Mark Mother and Obscured by Clouds hadn't done terribly well, either critically or sales-wise. And there was a new feeling that this music would kind of really put them over.
But it's really funny, because we draw on those albums, and actually there's some beauty in there.
Oh,
and the audience absolutely loves them.
Yeah.
Love them. And we play Atom Heart Mother.
Yeah,
I think, obviously this was going to change their lives, wasn't it? A bit like, you know, I mean, any band has that moment that piece of music changed.
It's funny, I saw them at a free concert in the park in 1970, and I hated it. And it was real Set the Control Star Sun, Careful with the Axe. Those are the centrepieces of their set at that point.
Yeah.
And there's something about Roger's kind of quite aggressive delivery and sort of vibe he put out. Didn't like them one bit, but Kevin Ayers and Whole World, who supported him, absolutely fell in love with
him. But that was all part of, wasn't that sort of, the Cambridge scene was kind of close to that.
Well, that's what, like,
Canterbury, hang on, I got my scenes right?
Well, no, Canterbury, Cambridge. The thing is that there wasn't really a Cambridge scene, because the Floyd, two of them were down in London doing architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Half of them were architecture students, weren't they?
Well, Nick and Roger were.
Yeah, that's right. And so basically they have always been a London band, even though as individuals they came.
Yeah, very much as we discussed earlier with the UFO Club and Joe Boyd, right?
Yeah, well, whilst the Canterbury scene was slightly different, but even people in the Canterbury scene deny there was such a thing as a Canterbury scene. It's very much a sort of post-fact sort of, you know, music journalists kind of construct. It just didn't really exist at all.
No.
But, anyway, I mean,
I think I said earlier about when was my first Floyd moment.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably one of these days with the dancers, the dancing animation on Olga was a Test.
Yes. Yeah, those old cartoons.
Yeah.
One of these days is pretty awesome, I think. Absolutely. Awesome. Do you
open
this?
We're going to open the show with that.
Okay.
Yeah. I always want things to hurry up with. It's like Shannon and Crazy Diamond. It's just such a great. such a great song. But it's like 3 minutes of nothing in the middle.
If I was just to say in two words what Pink Floyd is about, it's delayed gratification.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, it's funny you mention that, because the second of the Enemy pieces by the great Ian MacDonald, I think one of the great music writers, and it's a year after the release of the album, and he's essentially looking at why it's become this you know, incredibly
huge thing,
huge selling album already by this point, and he says, and he has real issues with it. I don't think it's not a complete slag off, but he says it's far too serious. And another thing, it's hopelessly slow. Not a single rocker among its six songs. But actually, it's a quite thoughtful piece about what Dark Side kind of meant in terms of musical culture at that time. Talking about, you know, the whole theme of hanging on in quiet desperation and all of that.
Well, you know, I think Roger came from a, you know, he was a middle class kid, you know, his dad was killed in the war.
That's,
you
right.
know,
yes.
he was part of that transformative generation that you know, in another time he would have stayed in a very class ridden. You know, he would have worked in the civil service, probably.
Yeah,
very,
you know?
Very probably.
And
yeah.
I think what was concerning him were particularly based upon that transition.
Yeah.
And how he felt about himself being famous and being a rock artist and classless, if you like. Because there is a mention in that article about somehow that he, you know, someone had written that, you know, Dark Side was a socialist concept album.
Yes.
That's a stretch.
Given his politics now. Yeah. Given Roger's politics now, which we won't address. What are the plans with Source of Fall? What's happening this year?
We're hoping on doing some shows this year in various places, but it's not been announced as I speak.
I may have to come along.
We'll all be there. We'll all be there. I wanted just to talk about David Crosby, who you had on the Rock on Tour podcast quite quite early or quite soon after you started. It was the beginning of lockdown, and you're talking about you're ever going to be able to play live again, and
well,
so forth.
Well, that was the thing. You know, he was one of the first ones we did, and he'd agreed to do it because he's a friend of Guy's.
Right.
And Guy, Guy got to know him through David Gilmour when he played with David, and Guy, actually, I think Guy had met him previously when he was playing with Icehouse. They did they were doing an open air show somewhere, and they were sharing the bill, and David managed to get Icehouse to let him have their Winnebago because it had a proper cooker in there, and he could take his chemistry set in there. And then obviously, you know, he played with Gilmour and Guy had always had to do Crosby's harmonies on In an Island, which he said are extraordinary. They're just not anything that anyone would think about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that wonderful close harmony work that they really invented between him and Nash.
And he Stills, probably more than any of them was the sort of arranger of those harmonies,
absolutely.
I think.
I'm a confession time. I'm a Grateful Dead fan of a certain period, right?
Let's get that out of the way.
I can see the lip curling over there. And he was very big friends with the Dead. He taught them how to sing. This is a band who really couldn't sing. You listen to
they weren't artists. Listening then, were they?
you say that. You listen to American Beauty. You listen to American
lovely
Beauty.
Harmonies.
The harmonies are fantastic on it. And that is David Crosby.
Yes. And they're on, you know, his great solo album, if I can really remember my name.
Exactly.
You know, and that's his really one of his great achievements.
And you probably go back to the Byrds.
Yeah, oh, sure.
And obviously the Byrds had this strange influence, which was obviously partly Dylan, partly the Beatles. And they kind of, would you say they made the first sort of rock country album?
Well, that's later. That's the Graham Parsons.
Well, Chris, I mean, actually, if there's anyone is the godfather of country rock, it's probably Chris Hillman.
Right.
On the first two Byrds albums, he just sort of slips a bit of country into there.
Right.
But, I mean, they're such a strange band because they all write so different.
Very much out of the folk tradition as well.
Yeah.
So,
and those harmonies, would that have gone back to Barbershop?
Well, actually, for some reason, because Crosby's, you know, was sort of rooted in Hollywood. He was a real Hollywood brat, wasn't he? So, I mean, he grew up listening to jazz and to, you know, soundtracks and things like that. So he was steeped in that kind of musicality.
My 10-year-old loves Glenn Miller. Right. So if you looked under the apple tree with anyone else but me, if you listen to those harmonies, how close and tight they are, extraordinary stuff going on in there. That would have been his background.
No, I think absolutely. In a sense, I mean, you know, as a songwriter, he wrote a few.
It's probably 10 really good songs.
Exactly, but out of the whole career, it's not a hell of a lot.
Compared to Still.
Well, 8 Miles High, one of the first. Yeah, it was probably American Psychedelia being
But that was written by Gene Clark.
And he was a fairly average guitar player.
Yes.
But I think this focusing on what he did about harmonies is really, really central to his importance. But also his ubiquity. He's Zelig. He goes from one hot scene to another hot scene until drugs trip him up.
Well, he is one of the key figures of the sort of protesting counterculture.
Yeah,
he's
the
however bogus sometimes that was, he's the guy who's like, you know, tear down the government. Yes. Kennedy was, it was an...
He almost cut his hair.
And he kept that
and he almost cut his hair.
You know, and I think, you know, he was obviously the obvious one because he had that big moustache. But he was, I think he was the communicator. He was definitely the, you know, Stephen was the great guitar player and, you know, Graham seemed to turn very humble once he'd met the band, you know, after the Hollies. Because in a way, I don't know whether Graham maybe, did he ever feel like he was properly American and part of it? I don't know.
It's about as American as you can get as a Brit, isn't it?
But what a scene that was in Mama Cass's garden,
place.
Right?
Yeah. But also in the Moscow Road. I mean,
when they were here.
Way before they even had made a record, they were working in bloody Bayswater. You know,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. There's all kinds of stuff like that. And then drugs tripped him up. Now, I think there's a lot of people reckon that the death of his girlfriend in 1969,
Christine Henson,
in a car crash,
that he head on. It was just awful, devastating.
really did him in. Because he's basically, he was, oddly enough, he's been kind of a one-woman man most of his life. Like Jan.
Jan Dahl.
I mean, they were
Susan three bass buddies.
Susan Rogers, who, the engineer, she told me this great story. She was working as a tape op in Graham Nash's studio in Los Angeles. Had to go out and pick up David and Jan from the airport. They come out carrying a cardboard box with their possessions, get in her car. He sets his leg alight trying to freebase while on the drive on the way to the hotel. He gets to the hotel. He sets his room alight, freebasing. She has to smuggle him out of the treatment's back entrance of the hotel, you know. It was just awful.
No, it was really grim. You know, it was really grim. I mean, one of the pieces that we featured about David in the wake of his death was a piece... He was promoting the book Long Time Gone,
right,
which I think is really one of the great... Have you ever read Long Time Gone? It's one of the really the great music books, partly because it was co-written by Carl Gottlieb, who's just a fabulous human being. And he was the screenwriter for Jaws and other Hollywood movies. And he'd been a pal of Crosby's. So he wrote the book with... And it is... My God, it's a hair-raising really.
But let's also remember what David did as an A&R man, you know, yeah, as he says at the beginning of our Rock on Tour titles.
Yeah.
You know, I discovered Joni back in Florida,
He
brings Joni Mitchell up and then Jackson Browne.
Yeah, no, it's extraordinary. And then his ability to piss people off has been really remarkable. I mean, of all people to piss off, his longest... defending buddy Graham Nash. They had a massive falling out in the last 3-4 years, didn't they?
That was like, I mean, you can understand him falling out with Stephen, you can understand him falling out with Neil. You could never have anticipated that him happened. Falling out with Graham. You know, that felt very sad.
Yeah, I don't know what went on there. No. When we spoke to him, that had already happened.
Yeah,
and he was...
Right.
But the saddest thing was when he said to us, you know, I'm going to be 80 next week or something, and he said, you know, because of COVID going on, and he just said... You know, I'm scared I might never play again.
Right, yeah.
I think he did do some shows.
Yeah, he did do some shows.
He was making music. Yeah.
Also, I mean, I haven't heard the album, but I'm always really disapprove of musicians who become painters because they're generally shit. But Joan Byers did a portrait of him for that album, which is really quite good.
I have to say, I quite like Bowie's art. No, I think he did. Look, if that was a German expressionist, he'd be digging it, right?
I'd say Captain Beefheart was a genuinely good painter.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. Ronnie Wood, not.
Ronnie Wood is a disaster.
John Lennon, a great illustrator.
No.
No, you didn't like that?
No.
They were quite unique.
We have to do a separate episode.
Byers' portrait of Crosby.
In the spoof documentary I did, my brother and I did together, The Kemp's All True, I of course become a painter.
Yeah. Anyway. So I'm not treading on any toes here.
Listen, we're probably better wrapping up. I've got a few things I want to just mention. How are you for time?
I've got a guitar being delivered at my studio in about...
That's quite important.
At 2 o'clock, I think. But we'll just finish off a few
things which are going to the library. Last week, this is Philip Elwood in the San Francisco Examiner in 1973. The remarkable thing about the rock group called the New York Dolls, who began a 3-night engagement last night at the New Matrix on Broadway, is that they're so consistently awful. Lauded to the skies by some commentators and observers of the rock scene, apparently those who don't listen, the Dolls have sometimes been compared to the Rolling Stones, and therein, I think, lies a significant point of reference. There we go. That was...
Yeah, it's funny because even people who knew the Dolls couldn't
really... Was that Bob Harris?
Yeah, he's on the lot.
I never saw the Dolls, but I saw Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers lots of times, and they were phenomenal.
But sometimes they were just a complete mess. That was part of it. This week, there's a couple of things. There's Richard Goldstein's review of Revolver for the Village Voice, August 1966. And it's partly a review, partly Richard Goldstein being discursive and wonderful. He says things like, "Mini skirts and mod men look with mixed envy and scorn at the hordes of Madras crew-cut gleamers who have made the trek across the sea, American tourists. And this year, the mob is bigger than ever. There is a supreme British tolerance for bad weather, cold tea, and young Americans in T-shirts that say, 'Swinging London, Carnaby Street' on the back. But beneath the bemused affection lies deep suspicion that, as a cowboy, you're liable to come out shooting when the local pub keeper says, 'Time, gentlemen, please.'" It's just as Richard Goldstein has done. Now, there's something that's raised through this. Pete Johnson, LA Times, 1968, sees Joni Mitchell play the troubadour. He says, "Her voice flies flawlessly through the songs, never settling into routine interpretation, but embroidering everything beautifully," and so on. It's a rave review. Step forward 5 years to 1973, Judith Sims and Rolling Stone on the Troubadour itself. She says, "Why was Joni Mitchell recently playing the Troubadour Folk Club for several nights when she could play for as many people and more money in just one concert at the Pavilion or Santa Monica Civic? Was it love of her audiences, an urgent desire to be close to the public, or abiding fondness for Doug Weston, owner of the Troubadour? None of these, probably. Joni was playing out her fifth and final option at the club, one of Doug Weston's famous contract options that keep top-draw performers returning to the club long after they can fill huge halls for money." So I love that. This is 5 years later. She's playing the very last of her five options.
But we were talking earlier about place, you know, and scenes beginning in places, and the Troubadour, obviously, is that American version, isn't it? Like CBGBs or the Mud Club.
Yeah. Talking of the Troubadour and that whole scene, I'm going to mention a memory I have of you and I going to Dingwalls to see J.D. Salva, John David Salva, who was the sort of unsung hero. And
I find the idea of Gary Kemp going to see J.D. Salva inherently hilarious.
There you go.
I just wonder why this great-looking, talented guy never got the gal.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Well, he got all the girls.
But he never got the metaphorical one.
He never got the bank account one.
He wasn't in the Eagles. And I always thought, you know what, that's the place...
But he could... I'm sure if he'd said, "Guys, can I be an Eagle?" They probably would have said yes.
He was on the cover, wasn't he?
But he'd be nicking all their girlfriends. I mean, probably...
David Geffen always said that, you know, he didn't think that J.D. Salva was a band member. He was a solo artist. But then, of course, came Salva Hillman Furey Band, which kind of proved the point.
They were terrible.
Exactly.
But he shared a house with Jackson Brown, didn't he?
There's this fantastic little house in Echo Park, which is Jackson Brown living upstairs and Glenn Frey and J.D. Salva living downstairs. And out of that came Take It Easy, which Jackson co-wrote. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a lot of artists at that time, you know, who were never quite sure if they were going to be songwriters or artists. You know, now everyone wants to be the artist songwriter, don't they? But, you know, and I think there were a lot of people that, you know, even Dylan, when he started, I'll just be a songwriter. Or the Beatles, you know, they thought that was going to last long, I'll just be a songwriter.
Yeah.
And I think was that his mentality?
I think in the end he just didn't have the sort of extrovert personality to be a solo artist on stage. Right. He just didn't have that quality. He was quite a brooding sort of introverted figure. No, although the guy we met was very, very charming. But he wasn't Glenn Frey. And he wasn't even Jackson Brown, I think is probably what it comes down to.
Well, it's probably difficult to say because those guys come with the baggage of history, don't they? That they impress us. That when we meet them, we know so much about them because of Reddit in
more than they know about themselves.
Well, you say that, but like Jackson Brown was a hustler from his teenage years. I mean, hanging out with Nico in New York in 1966. You know, Jackson was a hustler in a way that maybe J.D. Salva simply wasn't.
I mean, Carole King was part of that songwriting. To a certain extent,
she's definitely a songwriter who you would never in New York in 1962, even though she had a couple of pop hits, you could never have anticipated her
making Tapestry
one of the biggest selling albums of all time. No. You know, but listen, we must wrap up. Jasper, have you got any?
I'll
pieces?
Just very just briefly mention two things. First of which is a review of Björk's Homogenic James Hunter and Spin, album. And he just writes about it really, really well and really interestingly. Björk, unlike so many before her, doesn't demonise the artificial and assign innocence to the natural. Instead, she keeps refining her more comfortably developed view, a vision that's neither tormented by machines nor too squished up by hippie dogma. She senses cutting-edge sophistication in trees and hears a lovably daft awkwardness in drum machines. Björk constantly mixes it up, less out of perversity or cleverness than an abiding faith in how things strike her. Mm. In the process, she's managed to make anxious everyday life glitter.
Well, there's that great video, film of her taking the TV apart.
Yeah, oh, it's wonderful. Where she's like 13 or something, and she's on Icelandic television taking, demonstrating the innards of a television.
She's someone I brilliant. Don't necessarily like what she does, but I really admire her. She's, you know, because she's ploughed her own
complete
path.
Artist.
Yeah, absolutely. Really, absolutely.
Yeah. And I think it's one of her finest albums.
That's true.
I really do.
And then, lastly, apropos of the Chuck D Fight the Power documentary that has come out, a live review of Gods of Rap live at Manchester Arena on May the 11th, 2019. Rob Hughes reviews it for Uncut, and it's Public Enemy, Wu-Tang Clan, and De La Soul. You know, doing one show, which is a pretty great bill.
It's a revivalist bill.
It's interesting because it's like hip hop realizing, oh, hang on a minute, we've got now this history we can draw on, and we can do the same thing that rock has been doing for ages and just go back and.
Have you seen the documentary?
I haven't seen it yet, but I do want you've
seen it all, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, it's very good and it's also very flawed because it takes a relentlessly positive view of hip hop, which is great as a political thing, as a thing that's changed black society and so on and so forth.
But it's economical.
But it's economical
truth.
With certain truths. I mean, it brushes on the misogyny of so much hip hop, and it talks around the gang sort of culture.
Is that the problem? Because it's an artist who's producing.
Yes, an artist also who's very political in himself. So this will be very evangelistic. It's very good about the very early days of hip hop. Graham was a Theodore. The Cool Herc.
Good footage that you haven't seen before.
There's a lot of the usual talking heads. Well, they aren't the usual talking heads. They're quite interesting talking heads. You know, Moni Love is one of them, with a curious sort of hybrid South London American accent that she's sort of got now. It's really, really worth seeing. It's probably the best documentary I've seen on hip-hop, but I do think it's quite flawed.
Interesting. Cool. But yeah, no, it sounds like it was a great gig, this Gods of Rap thing, and a lot of hip-hop shows can be a bit challenging, but what I like from this is when Wu-Tang come on, Rob Hughes writes that they're urged on by an ever more frenzied crowd, at least half of whom don't look like they were even conceived when Enter the Wu-Tang 36 Chambers exploded in late 1993. This, perhaps, is an indicator of Wu-Tang Clan's enduring reach, their cocky, free associative sketches of urban life amplified by squadrons of subsequent rappers from Kanye West to Kendrick Lamar. And I think that is interesting because there is that sort of slight bump, as you're saying, you know, gangster rap, but then pre-gangster rap and then the kind of more political stuff has really made a comeback.
I think that's cool. It's a very I have kind of a love-hate relationship with hip-hop. There's chunks of it I absolutely adore. I mean, hearing Don't Believe the Hype was for me a bit like the first time I heard Hendrix doing Purple Haze. I hated it. And then 2 months later, a massive light bulb went on. It's actually the best thing I'd heard for years, you know. But there's a lot of darkness around.
I'm a big fan of Kendrick Lamar, really.
Oh, yeah, he's terrific.
Speaking of scenes earlier, I mean, the scene that, not to harp on about jazz scenes, but the West Coast jazz scene that play on To Pimp a Butterfly.
You mean with Thundercat
and Kamasi Washington and all those guys. Absolutely. You know, that I love To Pimp a Butterfly is absolutely one of my favourite.
I think one of the interesting things is that when they found that they couldn't really use samples anymore because 90% of their royalties would be going to a million different artists.
I know, I was so upset about that.
Well, I agree. Yes and no. On the one hand, I think actually the use of samples is fantastic and creative in itself, but it has forced people to actually looking to generate their own music, which has had some really good results.
I'm to be honest, I'm just upset that Kanye is such a twat because I thought he was one of the greatest producers in music.
He was a brilliant man.
Baffling and awful what's happened there.
That's it.
We've got to let Gary go.
Thank you.
He's got a guitar arriving. I don't want to get in between you and the and
what
the
sort of
guitar
have you got arriving?
Oh, no, it's my number one. It's old, and it's one I take on tour with
and
me.
What is it?
It's a Fender Strat that I've had since 1981.
Excellent.
And it's had all kinds of changes to it over the years, but I still play it as my main guitar.
Did you write True on
it? I didn't write on it, but I did record it.
Right.
Yeah. Nice.
Fantastic.
Beautiful. Nice. Thank you so much for joining us, Gary. So such a great pleasure. Thank you. Really, we had such a ball.
It's been huge fun.
Yeah, it's lovely doing it in person because we, you know, it's since the beginning of lockdown, you know, we've done probably many more episodes, you know, on Zoom. But great. We'll be back in 2 weeks with the American writer Fred Goodman, who wrote the wonderful book, The Mansion on the Hill. But we're going to be talking a lot about his new book about...
Is that about Chateau Marmont?
Music.
No, Mansion Hill's about the music business. Yes. It's a really brutal takedown, actually, of sort of corporate capitalism.
Yes, it's about everyone from Albert Grossman to David Geffen to John Landau, and it's a really extraordinary
book. It's a big book. What's the new one about?
The new one is about rock movies. It's his analysis of the best music films from like Don't Look Back to This Is Spinal Tap.
Right.
And he's a very, very good writer, and he's coming on board Rock's Back Pages.
Is he?
Which is very good news.
Because there's quite a lot of stuff lurking around of him.
Yes, exactly. we'll talk about this after the episode.
Thanks, right, Brett. I gotta go.
Yes, remains for us to say thanks for coming on. If you want more Gary, go and check out The Rock on Tours.
It's really good.
And look out for Sourceful of Secrets performances announced. Coming this year.
Coming soon.
Yes, great.
Bye.
That concludes episode 145 of the Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Gary Kemp. Visit his website at garykemp.com and find the Rock on Tours podcast wherever you listen to this one. The hosts are Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rock's Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews at rocksbackpages.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.